Chapter 14. Dorothy Kilgallen's relentless pursuit of the truth, her asking questions no other reporter was asking, caused attorney-author Mark Lane to write of Kilgallen, "She was a very, very serious journalist. You might say she was the only serious journalist in America who was concerned with who killed John Kennedy and getting all of the facts about the assassination." Lane was right, and her insightful columns continued even after the Ruby trial ended, since unanswered questions still lingered in her mind. Certainly Kilgallen's ears perked up on the afternoon of March 13, 1964, when Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander rose to address the jury. In a confident tone, he said, "I'm not defending Oswald, but American justice demands that he was entitled to protection from the law as a living, breathing American citizen." Scowling, Alexander then turned toward Oswald's assassin. As Kilgallen winced, Alexander shouted at him, calling Ruby the judge, jury, and executioner, one who committed a thrill kill, seeking notoriety. The harsh words caused Kilgallen to sympathize with Ruby's plight. Was he also a patsy? The same word Oswald had used when questioned about his involvement in the JFK assassination. Was Ruby a sacrificial lamb? The fall guy for those masterminding the president's death? After a long recess following Henry Wade's final argument, Melvin Belli addressed the jurors. Kilgallen took extensive notes. Belli proclaimed, "The important evidence from the doctors clearly proved Ruby insane." Belli told the jurors Ruby did not belong in prison. Belli asked for justice, despite knowing that Ruby was getting anything but justice. As the lawyers conferred over jury instructions, Kilgallen noticed Jack Ruby sitting by himself at the defense counsel's table. His shoulders were slumped, his head bowed. Was that a tear she noticed dripping down his face, his hand wiping it away? A scratch pad was near, and Ruby twirled a pencil in his hand. But when he turned toward her, his face was a blank slate, his eyes hollow, a confused and beaten man for sure. This was an image she would carry with her following the trial, one that triggered sympathy despite Ruby having been a cold-blooded killer. Finally, Kilgallen, a sad look on her face, noticed Ruby's brother Earl approach, and the two brothers sat arm in arm. As they whispered, Kilgallen reviewed her notes about the final arguments. She realized Belli had never asked the jury to spare Ruby's life if he was found guilty. Why he hadn't done so, a staple in any capital case, was one more reason to wonder whether Belli's defense had been adequate. The Ruby jury deliberated on March 14, 1964. Kilgallen sat in her hotel room confronting suspicions that something was terribly wrong with the trial. She sensed that Belli seemed to have thrown the case like a punch-drunk fighter. The telephone rang. The jury had reached a verdict. Racing toward the courthouse, she ran into Belli. Excited, he told her, "No jury in the world will convict Ruby with less than 3 hours of deliberation." Outside the courtroom, Bill Alexander told this author that reporters surrounded him. One, he said, asked if Belli surprised the prosecution by not pleading for Ruby's life. Alexander explained to this author that he informed the reporters, "Yes, I am shocked," while adding that Ruby was going to get the chair, and that he felt kind of sorry for Ruby. Alexander said Belli took a good 5-year murder without malice case and made it into a death penalty one for his client. At 11:14 a.m., television cameras were set to record the Ruby verdict. Kilgallen sat nervously with the other journalists awaiting Ruby's fate. She could not take her eyes off him. 2 hours and 19 minutes after Max Causey was selected foreman, not all of it spent deliberating, the jurors were somber as they filed into the courtroom. Causey later said that two main issues were discussed by the jury in an overheated room filled with cigarette smoke and packed with tension. The first was, is Jack Ruby legally sane at the present time? And if so, was there malice aforethought on Ruby's mind at the time of the shooting of Oswald? When the jurors unanimously answered yes to this question, Causey said he asked about the second issue, what they thought the proper penalty should be for the convicted killer. He wrote, 9 indicated death as the penalty, 2 asked for life, 1 for 60 years. The next vote was 10-2 for death, and minutes later, 12-0 for execution. The jurors took their seats in the courtroom, but none of them glanced in Ruby's direction, and Belli knew what this meant. He turned toward his client and whispered, "It's bad. Take it easy. We expected it all along, and we tried this case for an appeal court. We'll make it there. I'll stick with you." Only half-hearing Belli's words, Ruby's face was ashen. Any hope of freedom dashed. A minute later, Foreman Causey handed the verdict form to Bailiff Beau Mabra. He, in turn, passed it to Judge Brown. After shuffling through the pages and reviewing it, the judge read the words aloud without expression. "We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder with malice, as charged in the indictment, and affix his punishment at death." Judge Brown then quickly asked, "Is this unanimous? So say you all? Please hold up your right hands." All 12 jurors did so. In the courtroom, the crowd appeared dazed and confused as to how to react. There was no eruption of cheering and no sobbing. Reporters scurried to write their stories. Each hid emotion behind blank faces. Ruby's sister Eileen, tears welling in her eyes, and his brother Earl bowed their heads. Ruby appeared dazed, a look of puzzlement and confusion apparent on his face. Had he really heard the words, "affix his punishment at death"? In her seat, Kilgallen, visibly shaken, gasped at the death penalty verdict, her eyes centered on Ruby's bowed head. When she wrote death on the notepad in her assassinations file, she did so with an unsteady hand. Deputies quickly marched Ruby out of the courtroom as Belli's loud voice condemned the verdict. As Ruby disappeared from view, Kilgallen told herself the whole truth had not been told. She was certain there had been a conspiracy. After typing quickly in the press room, she forwarded her report to the Journal American. Then she headed for the hotel bar and a stiff drink, vodka and tonic the preference. On March 19th, the Ruby family fired Belli. Later, Judge Joe Brown said he had talked to the jury, and they had told him Belli offered them no alternative, but either an acquittal or an extreme penalty. Brown also scolded Belli for never fitting the facts to the possibility of murder without malice, a homicide committed under extreme passion, created by passion or horror, or resentment or horror, that renders a mind incapable of cool reflection, giving the jury a choice for a conviction carrying a maximum sentence of 5 years. On March 20th, 1964, Kilgallen's Journal American Voice of Broadway column read, "The point to be remembered in this historic case is that the whole truth has not been told. Neither the state of Texas nor the defense put all of its evidence before the jury. Perhaps it was not necessary, but it would have been desirable from the viewpoint of all of the American people." Nearly a month later, on April 14th, 1964, Kilgallen, ignoring the warnings of danger from Mark Sinclair and James Clement, was at it again, headlining her Journal American column with the daunting words, "Why did Oswald risk all by shooting Cop?" She wrote, "A mysterious and significant aspect of the events following the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas has never been explored publicly. although it must have occurred to crack reporters covering the case, as well as authorities investigating the tragedies. The important question, why did Lee Harvey Oswald, presumably fleeing from the police after the assassination, approach patrolman J.D. Tippett's car in broad daylight with witnesses standing by and shoot the policeman 3 times, although he had not said a word to Oswald? Oswald had managed to slip away from the scene and was, up to that point, not a reckless one. A man who knows he is wanted by the authorities after a spectacular crime does not seek out a policeman usually, unless he has decided to give himself up, and certainly Oswald was not doing that. By shooting Tippett, instead of trying to make himself inconspicuous, Oswald put himself in double jeopardy. His act almost guaranteed his arrest. Why? A whodunit fan would infer that the policeman knew something about Oswald that was so dangerous the policeman had to be silenced at any cost, even Oswald's chance at escape and freedom. Without doubt, the central theme running through all of Kilgallen's columns is Jack Ruby, the assassin whom Kilgallen had decided to concentrate on instead of the other alleged assassin, Oswald. To everyone consumed with Hoover's Oswald alone theory, this would have seemed an illogical strategy. But to her, it was quite logical. From the very day she had watched Ruby shoot Oswald, Kilgallen had questioned the official version of what happened. Until now, the foundation for Kilgallen's stirring articles and columns before, during, and after the Ruby trial, leading up to her death less than 2 years later, have been pieced together using as many primary sources as possible, while being limited in scope. Fortunately, for history's sake, a breakthrough occurred when this author secured, through the cooperation of noted California attorney Greg Mullinax, an official copy of the Jack Ruby trial transcripts in late 2017, ones never before published in their original form. Nearly 2,000 pages in length, stretching a foot and a half tall, the transcripts, which this author closely scrutinized for nearly 2 weeks, provide an invaluable guide to what Kilgallen saw and heard from her front row seat at the trial. Most importantly, this permits a window into her mindset, a unique window, as she witnessed firsthand accounts on a daily basis of giant historical proportions. Kilgallen's ability to do so proves that her investigation of the JFK and Oswald assassinations is without doubt the most compelling, the most credible in history, that her investigation has been virtually ignored for the past 50 years and counting, is a true distortion of history, one that must cease immediately. The most important aspects of the trial testimony, their actual pages presented here, began on February 11, 1964, when Kilgallen had, as noted, watched Ruby's lawyers skirmish with prosecutors and Judge Brown, attempting to move the trial from Dallas to other Texas locales. Belli and his colleagues believed the enormous publicity adhering to the Oswald shooting by Ruby would prevent their client from getting a fair trial. A glimpse of the courtroom indicates the respective positions of the lawyers and the judge for the monumental trial. To bolster their belief that the trial needed to be moved to another locale, the defense called as a witness prominent businessman Stanley Marcus, president of the famed Neiman Marcus department stores. Melvin Belli handled the Q&A in a courtroom that was somber in tone. After all, while spectators, the attorneys, the judge, and reporters alike, including Kilgallen, noted a certain pomp and circumstance atmosphere to the proceedings in a stuffy courtroom packed to the limit, Jack Ruby's life was at stake. Despite Marcus's testimony, and that of several other witnesses called by Ruby's lawyers, that neither the defense nor the prosecution could get a fair trial in Dallas, Judge Joe Brown denied the defense motion for change of venue, even though Joe Tannehill had claimed there was a poisonous atmosphere in Dallas about Ruby's crime. During the trial, pivotal points of historical importance filtered through the testimony, as those present leaned forward so as to clearly hear words from those who had been eyewitnesses to the events surrounding the assassinations. Several times during the days ahead, gasps might be heard as a witness provided damaging testimony about Ruby. All eyes were certainly on Oswald's killer and his family, positioned in a front row seat, including his brother Earl. Sketch artists also added their flavor to the daily grind so as to capture first-hand images of those who were participants in the trial of the century. Space limits the number of witness accounts that may be included here, but certainly important testimony excerpts from the 4th and 5th of March, 1964, on the very pages that the court reporters used to preserve the historical record, must be noted. As the witnesses paraded to the stand, Dorothy Kilgallen, fashionable as always, readied her pencil and notebook, making certain to not miss important facts for her daily Journal American columns and the book she was writing for Random House. Prosecution witness Don Campbell, advertising salesman, Dallas Morning News. It does. Now, Mr. Campbell, where was Jack Ruby in the office at the time that you left at 12:25?
He was sitting at a desk directly behind mine, belonging to Mr. John Newman.
And what was he doing at the time you last saw him?
He was writing some copy for his nightclub ad.
And I will ask you if the corner of the second floor office, from which it is possible to see the Texas School Book Depository, a Mr. Jeffries has a small glassed-in office there.
He has.
And I will ask you if standing outside Mr. Jeffries' door, looking through that second window from the corner, if it is possible to see the Texas School Book Depository.
Yes, most of the building.
Now, what time here in Dallas was the president assassinated?
According to the newspaper stories, about 12:35.
About 12:35. And Jack was with you from 12 o'clock to 12:25, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And then he left you just before the assassination, is that right? Actual transcript of the court testimony. Prosecution witness John Newman, retail advertising staff, Dallas Morning News. And what time did you arrive back at your office?
Approximately 12:40.
At the time that you went back to your office, did you know that the president had been shot?
I did not.
When you arrived at your office, I will ask if you saw the defendant in this case, Jack Ruby.
Yes, sir, I did.
Do you see Jack Ruby in the courtroom?
Yes, there is Jack sitting there.
All right. When you got back to your office at 12:40, where did you see Jack Ruby?
At my desk.
I will ask you if word was passed out that President Kennedy had been shot.
Yes, it was.
What, if anything, did you do as regards getting up to date news or watching television about the assassination?
In the corner of our office, in our promotion director's office, there was a small television set, which he uses on occasions.
And what is the name of that man?
Mr. Dick Jeffrey.
All right. I will ask you if you saw Jack Ruby in front of Mr. Jeffrey's office watching the television.
Yes, I was over there myself, and Jack was over there, listening with the rest of them.
Did you hear him say anything?
I don't recall any specific comments at that time. There was a lot of comment.
Was there anything unusual about his behavior at any time that you saw him that day?
Nothing unusual, I would say. No more than anyone else.
Have you looked out the window which is opposite Mr. Jeffrey's door toward and across the plaza towards the Dallas Hotel?
Yes, sir.
I will ask you if it is possible to see the building known as the Texas School Book Depository from that window.
It is.
I will ask you if he could be characterized as a rather volatile, excitable individual, talked fast, talked loud, perhaps waved his arms sometimes when excited, or just tell us how he appeared to you.
Well, yes, I think Jack is excitable. our conversations at times, he would tell me that he was, and sometimes he would be more so than others.
Well now, how long had it been since the president was assassinated before you and Jack learned about it?
I would say possible 15 minutes.
15 minutes. And during that time you learned he was assassinated, you say Jack appeared to be calm and composed, is that right?
Yes, sir. End of transcript.
What did Kilgallen think of the Campbell and Newman testimony? Little doubt exists that she must have wondered about Ruby having been present in the newspaper office, one with windows clearly aimed at the book depository a short distance away, at or near exactly the time when JFK was assassinated. Was this simply coincidence? Hard to believe. Or on purpose? And if the latter, did it cause the wily reporter to suspect that Ruby may have had prior knowledge of the exact location and time when JFK was set up to die? If true, this meant Ruby was definitely part of a conspiracy, start to finish, connected to those who had masterminded JFK's demise. Through the spiral-bound Mohawk notebook diary, kept by juror number 10, Wayman Rose, and secured by this author, there is confirmation that the jury was aware of Ruby's activities when JFK was shot. Rose, known to be the court jester among the jurors, wrote on pages 25 and 26, "It seems Ruby was in their office at the time of assassination," referring to the DMN office. In addition, what did Kilgallen think of Ruby, dubbed excitable by witness Newman, simply remaining calm and composed, without any outburst over the death of the president, a contrary emotion to the one he projected later? Ruby also watched television coverage with a direct view of the book depository, thus keeping abreast of developments by law enforcement. If Ruby's conduct was deliberate, and he didn't just happen to be in the newspaper offices so conveniently located close to the book depository, then Kilgallen must have surmised that questions existed as to the veracity of the entire story he had told the authorities, including how he happened to kill Oswald. Transcript from the actual court records. Prosecution witness, William Duncan Jr., newsman, KLIF Radio. Directing your attention back to Friday, November 22nd, 1963, in the early morning hours of Saturday, November 23rd, 1963, I will ask you if you were working as a newsman there at KLIF.
I was.
At that time, did you know the defendant in this case, Jack Ruby?
No, I did not. I met him by telephone, and later in person that same night.
All right, sir. Now I will ask you if sometime on Friday evening, late Friday or early Saturday morning, if you got a telephone call from a man who identified himself as Jack Ruby.
I did.
Will you tell us about what time that was you got the first call?
That would have been around midnight or shortly thereafter.
Now, with that preliminary, will you tell us about the conversation with him?
Well, this came just after Lee Harvey Oswald had been formally charged. At that time, I was working alone, and we were short-staffed, so I was quite anxious to get a hold of some information from the city hall. The man who telephoned, Jack Ruby, asked me if I would like to get some information. He asked me if I would like to talk to the district attorney, Henry Wade. I said I would. Then the district attorney was put on the phone, I talked to him, and recorded an interview with him, in line with the charging of Oswald.
All right. And about what time of night was it that he actually showed up at the radio station?
This would be somewhere between 1:30 and 1:45.
And did you talk to him there?
Well, he brought the sandwiches and some soda pop, some exotic cola, and he wanted to know if the talks I had with the district attorney were satisfactory. It seemed he was interested in the things that were happening, and I told him it was. And he stayed for about a half hour or 35 minutes, the best I can.
Break in cited transcript. He seemed excited. I shouldn't say excited, he seemed interested in what was happening. He was pleased that he had thought to ask Russ Knight,
who was a KLIF disc jockey, who had gone over to the city hall with a tape recorder, and also interviewed District Attorney Henry Wade with a tape recorder. Jack seemed pleased that he had suggested to Russ that he ask the district attorney whether or not Oswald was sane. We talked about the case and what was happening for about 35 minutes, and then Jack left. Did Ruby say anything about when they were going to move Oswald? Not to my recollection. Let me ask you if he told you that he had seen Oswald. Yes, he did. What did he say about having seen Oswald? He said that he had been in the city hall with the sandwiches and so forth in a bag, looking for someone from KLIF. Then, he said, all of a sudden, I am paraphrasing, all of a sudden, there was a large rush and commotion when Oswald was brought out to meet the press. He said he was caught up in people rushing, and the first thing he knew, he found himself standing in front of Oswald or close to Oswald. Was he pleased that he had seen Oswald? He seemed to be pleased, in the sense that he was being in on something that was important to everyone, yes. End of transcript. The exchange with witness Duncan provided Kilgallen with insight regarding Ruby's mindset on the night before he assassinated Oswald. Clearly, she knew. Ruby was interested in what was happening, perhaps on a scouting mission of some sort. Kilgallen also must have realized a prior personal relationship had to have existed between Ruby and D.A. Wade, permitting Ruby to set up not one, but two interviews with Wade by reporters. Kilgallen had also heard firsthand witness Duncan explain how Ruby brought sandwiches to the radio station, ingratiating himself with the reporters whom he knew could provide information regarding Oswald, perhaps even when he might be transferred the next day. Certainly, Kilgallen realized Ruby had no mental issues. He was calculating, all business, on the prowl, in the hunt toward a specific duty he had to fulfill. That is, kill Oswald. And she learned a most important point. Ruby admitted that at the Friday night news conference, he had found himself standing in front of Oswald or close to Oswald, clarified to, "There I was, standing there looking up, and he was right in front of me," or "close to me." In the file she kept close to her vest, Kilgallen must have noted these continuing confusing aspects to Ruby's behavior. This was not the portrait of someone deranged but perfectly logical in nature, with the main goal learning as much as he could about the man who he appeared to be stalking at every turn. That Ruby seemed to be pleased, in the sense that he was in on something that was important to everyone, must have caused Kilgallen to realize Jack Ruby was actually playing the part of a reporter through his words and actions.